Welcome to this audio description guide to the Museum of Iron, one of 10 museums run by the Ironbridge Gorge Museum Trust. This guide has been written by Specialist Access Advisor Zoe Partington and the museum's curators Jane Gallagher and Georgina Grant, with expert advice from Gavin Griffiths, audio and accessibility consultant. It is narrated by Amanda Phillipson, the museum's lifelong learning manager. We begin outside the museum with information about the facilities, including a cafe and accessible toilets, which are available before you go into the museum or after your tour. At the right-hand end of the museum building are some toilets in a separate building. Across the car park to the left of the museum is another large brick building named the Long Warehouse, which now houses a cafe called the Furnace Kitchen. It's located close to the exit from the car park, and visitors should note traffic will be moving in this area, so please take extra care when walking between the buildings. There are tables outside the cafe located in front of the windows. The Furnace Kitchen has level access and electronic doors which automatically open when entering the cafe. When leaving, please note that you will need to press the button located on the left-hand side of the doors to activate them. They open and close quickly, so please take care. As you enter the cafe, the counter for placing orders and for help to be seated is directly in front of you. The staff are very welcoming. Menus are available on the Furnace Kitchen's website and Facebook page, and there are large print versions in the cafe. Inside the cafe, there are tables dotted around the space with a small walkway between to the toilets. The door to the toilets is on the far right end of the wall. Go through this into a small corridor where directly ahead of you is the men's toilet. Turn left once in the corridor and the women's toilet is the next door on your right. And directly ahead of you, at the end of the corridor, is the accessible toilet. The accessible toilet is contrasted well with a patterned floor. When you are ready to proceed to the main museum building, leave the cafe and with the electronic doors behind you, proceed carefully forwards across the car park and turn diagonally left into the main entrance. The Museum of Iron presents the story of how iron was first produced in this part of Shropshire, beginning during occupation by the Romans and developing during medieval times. It explains how, with the arrival of Abraham Darby I in Coalbrookdale in 1709, the whole local area was rapidly industrialised, so that by the 20th century it was a place full of coal mines, furnaces, forges and railways. By using coke instead of charcoal as the fuel to produce iron, the Darby family, along with other local industrialists, completely transformed the region, Britain and its global economy, and the way we live now. If you wish, you can also visit the site of Darby's original iron furnace, which is close to this museum. Please ask for details at the reception desk in the museum. This guide will take you inside the museum, where you will find exhibits ranging from pictures to models of Darby's original furnace and the Iron Bridge. You'll see how iron produced here was put to a surprising variety of uses, from exquisite art castings, such as for sculpture, to furniture and garden ornaments. You'll see functional ironware too, used in industries and in homes for objects such as fireplaces, ovens and cookingware. The museum lies in what were formerly the works of the Coalbrookdale Company, and in the past the area surrounding the museum would have been busy and noisy and full of people working in various furnaces and workshops, all of which have since been demolished. Now you are in the middle of a large open yard, making it much quieter than it would have been then. The museum is housed in a substantial red brick building, originally one of the company's warehouses, and it is topped with a large ornamental cast iron clock tower. The clock face itself is black with gold-coloured Roman numerals on its dial, and below the face it is dated 1845. The clock is topped with a gilded ornate bell-shaped finial. The brick building has many white metal-framed windows with small panes repeated at regular intervals. They are spaced out across the building and repeated on each floor. On the right-hand side of the building, as you face it, there is the visible scar of a previous building which was connected to it and which now contrasts with the remaining wall surface, like a shadow from the past. You enter the museum through a pair of silver-coloured electronic double doors, which contrast against the red brick exterior walls. As you approach them, there is a large black iron cooking pot to the right of the doors with the words Museum of Iron Entrance. The doors open automatically, and on entering the museum, the reception desk is on your immediate left. This also doubles as the shop area, selling a range of gifts and books. Please ask the reception staff for help and information. This guide introduces the main galleries and highlights 16 of the most interesting and popular exhibits. If there are other objects you would like to know more about, please speak to the reception team. There are emergency exits throughout the building, and these will be located for you on the tour should you need to use them. Our first object on this tour is located with your back to the main doors, slightly to the left and ahead of you, and opposite the reception desk. It's a life-size cast iron statue. There is a small low-level barrier in front of the statue, so please take care. Object 1. Description: Eagle Slayer. This statue, known as the Eagle Slayer, was made in 1851, designed by a popular Victorian sculptor named John Bell and cast by the Coalbrookdale Company. The sculpture, made of cast iron, is monumental in size and weighs over 400 kilos. As a material, iron had previously only been used for industrial and practical purposes, and therefore this is the first piece of artistic sculpture ever to be made of cast iron. Its complex design meant that it had to be cast in several pieces and then fixed together. The Eagle Slayer was originally displayed at the Great Exhibition in 1851 and was painted white to imitate marble. The sculpture depicts a shepherd who, on discovering one of his sheep has been killed by an eagle, fires an arrow and kills the bird. The figure seems to be in motion, his face is raised and he looks up, having carefully aimed the deadly arrow skywards. One arm is holding the bow upwards, whilst the other has just released the arrow. The shepherd is naked, apart from a cloth draped over his middle, which also falls down over the back of the animal lying dead at his feet, along with a feather from the eagle. Directions into the first gallery space. Now, from the Eagle Slayer, go to your left, avoiding the low-level rope barrier in front of the statue, and then straight ahead into the first gallery. Here there are text panels on either side of the walls, one with a quote describing Coalbrookdale as the most extraordinary district in the world. With the large windows straight ahead, turn right into the main body of the gallery, so the windows will be on your left. This gallery has displays on the complex geology of Shropshire and explains how people from Roman times onwards, including during the medieval period, made wrought iron tools and weapons using charcoal as a fuel to fire their simple furnaces. The geology of the Ironbridge Gorge, containing large seams of coal, clay and ironstone or ore, along with outcrops of limestone, made the gorge an ideal place for iron and clay industries to flourish. The main body of the gallery has a large display case in the centre, whilst to the left, between the windows, are plinths with objects on them, including a wheelbarrow full of coal. The plinth at the far end of the gallery contains samples of ironstone and casts of fossils which you are welcome to handle. On the right, and slightly behind you, is a large curved wall, illustrated with a map of the local geology. Behind a large central case, there is a decorative bench with smaller cases running along the back wall. The second object described is set into the floor. Object 2. Fossil with reptile prints. As you go forwards into the gallery, there is an exhibit in a case under the floor with a glass surface as part of the floor. You can stand on the display case. This flat, rectangular slice of siltstone from the Grinsell Quarry in Shropshire contains many randomly placed footprints. The herbivorous reptile that made these bird-like footprints lived in the Triassic period, around 251 to 201 million years ago, and was called a Rhynchosaurus. This reptile had five claws on its hind feet, which would have been used to dig for roots or tubers hidden beneath soft silt or mud. The footprints in this fossil show only the three longest parallel claws, each about 3 centimetres in length. This unusual scaly creature was similar in size and shape to an otter. It was less than a metre in length, with short, angular legs like a crocodile. Some of the prints seem to have been rubbed out in this fossil, perhaps caused as the reptile moved across the ground during a foraging expedition. Move forward from the fossil until you come to the geology case object. Object 3, geology case. In the centre of the room stands a tall double-sided glass display case. Standing approximately 2 metres high and 2 metres long, the case holds over 50 samples of rocks, minerals and fossils from across the United Kingdom, Europe and North America. The front side of the case displays fossils which are individually displayed on small clear acrylic shelves. They range in size from a hazelnut to a dinner plate. There is also a black and white photograph and information about the industrialist and enthusiastic fossil hunter who collected them. His name was George Moore, and in his photograph he looks to our left. Pale-skinned, with hair brushed neatly over his head, he has a distinctive moustache and beard protruding lower than his chin and covering all of his neck. As a successful clay tile manufacturer based in Jackfield, a site on the other side of the River Severn from here, he spent much of his time marrying his day job with the gentlemanly pursuit of geology. Between the mid-1860s to the mid-1880s, he collected over 5,000 samples and produced 4 illustrated notebooks to accompany them. On the rear side of the display case, there are over 20 samples of rocks and minerals, which again are individually displayed on small clear acrylic shelves. Dotted amongst the rock samples, there are copies of 4 pages from George Moore's notebooks. Each page is framed with white card, showing stratigraphic diagrams and with handwritten notes which explain the geological location of some of the rock samples. The diagrams are painted in earthy colours, each representing the different layers of rock where the samples were found. If you are facing the rear side of the geology case, behind you is a wooden and cast iron bench with oak and ivy leaf design, which you are welcome to sit on. Object 4, Coalbrookdale Oak and Ivy Garden Bench. With its cast iron ends and wooden slatted seat, benches such as this one were mass-produced by the Coalbrookdale Company in the 19th century for the gardens of middle-class Victorians. If you wish to, you can rest your back and arms on the low cast iron frame, which is painted in a forest green colour. The design of the frame resembles a grand iron gate which has been reclaimed by nature. The creeping vines and leaves of ivy along the railings are accompanied by the leaves and acorns of a common oak tree. At the end of each armrest, you will find the head of a mythical beast with its mouth open. The feet of the bench are shaped like an animal's claw, mostly like a dog. You can touch all parts of this exhibit. This design was intended to reflect the flora within a Victorian garden and to blend seamlessly into its surroundings. Once you have finished in this gallery, go up to the second floor and then continue your visit down through the galleries to discover more exhibits. Directions to floor 2 and 1. With the bench behind you, go to your right to the far corner of the gallery and straight ahead through the double doors. Ahead of you is the lift with a button to the left at waist height. Take the lift to the second floor where the next part of our tour begins. When approaching the lift, there is an emergency exit directly to your left. Please note that this is up 2 brick steps. If you prefer to use the stairs, turn right and you will find the staircase with a blue carpet. There are 2 flights going up to a landing, then you turn left and continue up 2 further flights. At the top of this staircase, you turn right into a space where the lift is on your right and then turn left through a single doorway into the gallery space. To give some context, this is a large, long, rectangular room with a white painted ceiling and grey pillars down the left-hand side and central area of the gallery space. In the middle, there are exhibition displays, and around the edges, there are the objects and the display cases. The displays continue on this floor and then on floor 1 below, so make your way through this top floor gallery before ending at the stairs to floor 1. The emergency exit is at the far end of this gallery via the stairs to floor 1. There is also an evacuation chair close to the lift, which can be operated by museum staff in the case of an emergency when the lift must not be used. You are now at one end of the large top floor of the former warehouse. Above are the exposed wooden triangular trusses and beams which support the roof. The iron-framed windows, which light the gallery, are made up of small glass panes. Iron columns run the full length of the gallery, which also support the wooden roof beams. The cross pieces from the triangular wooden structures and the columns are easy to miss, so please be careful. The gallery is divided into three distinct areas, and we will give you an introduction to each area before moving on to describe items in these spaces in more detail. In this first section of the gallery, you will find display cases against the walls and a large display case in the centre featuring a model of a blast furnace showing how it operated. The first object of significance in this section is, however, a bloomery furnace located in a case on the right-hand wall. Object 5, bloomery furnace. Imagine you are in a managed woodland landscape comprising of trees of different heights and thicknesses. Spread through this landscape are open clearings, and within these there are people working to produce wrought iron in small furnaces fueled by charcoal produced from the woodlands. This type of small furnace was used and first introduced by the Romans and remained in operation until about the 1300s. This example was found in Suffolk in 1978 and is a complete and consequently very rare survival. Kept in a glass case, as its structure is too fragile to touch, it is a typical example of a bloomery furnace, which was capable of smelting about a kilo, or just over 2 pounds, of iron with each firing. The name comes from the bloom, the mix of the iron and waste products produced within it. The furnace is hollow, approximately 3 foot, or 1 meter high, and 2.5 foot, or half a meter in diameter, at its widest point towards the centre, and it tapers to about 1 foot or 30 centimetres at either end. The walls of the furnace are between 1 and 2 inches, or 2.5 to 5 centimetres thick, and would feel gritty, coarse and friable to the touch. It has a hole at the base, 4 inches or 10 centimetres wide, facing towards you, and a now blocked hole, approximately 2 inches or 5 centimetres, 3 quarters of the way up on the opposite side. Fuel for the bloomery is provided by charcoal, wood which has been heated to drive off the moisture within it, leaving behind a brittle black substance. Iron ore is roasted in a fire, and once prepared, the bloomery itself is heated with charcoal to a very high temperature. The prepared iron ore and more charcoal are then dropped into the top of the bloomery furnace in a ratio of 1 to 1. The smelting process is assisted with the use of hand bellows, but also relies on the skill of the metal worker to gauge when the bloom is ready through a combination of observing the heat and flames emerging from the bloomery. The large nugget-shaped piece of iron is then extracted from the bottom of the bloomery and placed on an anvil where it's alternately beaten with a hammer and then reheated to produce wrought iron. Directions to the furnace model. From the bloomery, turn around and move directly to the display case in the middle of the gallery, which contains a model of a blast furnace. Object 6, blast furnace model. In front of you is a rectangular glass case containing a scale model of the original old furnace, which is located close to this museum and is where Abraham Darby first smelted iron using coke instead of charcoal. The illuminated model has clear parts to represent the original parts of the furnace which still survive, and the white parts to show what has disappeared over time. The working model is operated by a push button at the near end on one of the descriptive panels. The model includes a water wheel at one end and above it a leat which runs almost halfway across the top of the water wheel and is illuminated with blue lights to indicate the flow of water to the wheel from the upper furnace pool located above it. There is also a representation of the blast furnace, showing how the molten iron runs from the bottom into moulds made of sand, and this area lights up as red to depict the heat of the furnace and the molten iron. There are 4 explanation panels providing information on how the furnace operated. Coke, iron ore and limestone were brought along a ramp where they were loaded into the open top of the furnace. Water from the upper furnace pool was used to turn the water wheel, which then powered large air bellows. This provided a continuous blast of air into the furnace, which was required to raise the temperature sufficiently to separate the iron from the iron ore. Once the temperature inside the blast furnace reached 1200 to 1300 degrees centigrade, it allowed the molten iron to be extracted by a process called tapping. The impurities in the iron float to the surface in the furnace. This waste material is called slag and was also tapped off. The molten iron ran from the base of the furnace into channels made in sand. In shape, these channels resembled a sow with piglets and gave rise to the term pig iron. Once cooled, the iron could be remelted and cast into products in a foundry or purified further to produce wrought iron. Directions to the Coalbrookdale cooking pot. To the left of the blast furnace model, go forwards in a diagonal line towards the cooking pot at a distance of about 7 metres. Object 7, Coalbrookdale cooking pot. This is a small black cast iron pot sitting on a grey plinth inside a Perspex case. It is nearly half a metre in diameter and is roughly the same in height. The pot sits on 3 short stumpy legs and has a handle at the top which attaches to either side of the pot. The cast iron is slightly pitted in texture and the pot resembles a small cauldron. Around the outer rim of the pot are interlinking white circles which have been cast into the design. They stand out in relief and form a chain-like pattern. Also cast into the pot and standing out in relief are the letters H, E, W and the date 1714. The interlinking white circles, the letters and the date suggest that the pot may have been made to celebrate a marriage. An alternative theory is that it might have been made for an employee of the Coalbrookdale Company. Despite the uncertainty surrounding its original purpose, we know that this is the earliest surviving Coalbrookdale pot. It was made just 5 years after Abraham Darby I perfected the method of smelting iron with coke, allowing him to produce many types of inexpensive ironware pots like this, which became a mainstay of the Coalbrookdale Company. From the cooking pot, go forwards to the right of the case for about 4 metres in a straight line down the centre of the gallery, following the grey pillars that are at a regular distance, and you will arrive underneath the clock tower. Now you are in the middle section of the gallery. In this area, there are 6 freestanding displays located throughout the space, which are formed from vertical walls with glass display cases and plinths. Each display concentrates on the neighbourhood's famous local ironmasters. These include 3 generations of the Darby family, all of whom were named Abraham, who established and operated the Coalbrookdale Company. Other industrialists, Richard Reynolds and his son William Reynolds, and John Wilkinson. You will also discover how, for a period in the late 1700s, the Coalbrookdale Company was run by the women of the Darby family. Above the centre of the high vaulted roof is the cast iron clock tower with the working clock. Please remember that it strikes very loudly on the hour. Object 8, clock tower. The square body of the clock consists of filigree cast iron panels painted red, resting on top of ornate red painted square cast iron panels that tilt slightly inwards towards the top. The top of the clock itself is supported by 4 white iron columns, with the top piece adorned with a spherical golden finial. The date of 1843 is marked on each of the lower 4 iron panels. The clock tower was added to the building at that date, and the golden finial copies the same design as the cabin stoves made for Isambard Kingdom Brunel's Great Western Steamship. We don't know why this clock tower was added 5 years after this building was built, but perhaps it was to celebrate the connection between Brunel and Coalbrookdale, as his SS Great Britain was also launched in 1843. More likely, the clock was installed to ensure employees got to work on time. Photographs from the 19th century show that the clock tower was also embellished at each corner with large eagle sculptures. There are no records of their design in the Coalbrookdale Company catalogues or of the date when they were removed. From the clock tower, go forwards to the left to a display cabinet at waist height above the floor. There is no plinth below, so it seems suspended from the panel behind. The case contains 2 women's bonnets. Object 9, Quaker bonnets. The Darbys and their extended family were Quakers, and these bonnets belonged to Quaker women. They were made in the 1800s and are very plain, without any adornment or decoration. They are both made of silk, with large cream ribbons attached to each side of the bonnets to be tied underneath the wearer's chin. The back section of the bonnets are ruched to create a textured section. Each bonnet resembles a simple cylindrical cone. When worn, it would not only cover the wearer's head, but also the sides of their face. The Religious Society of Friends, or Quakers as they are commonly known, emerged during a period of nonconformity following the English Civil War of 1642 to 1651, when people began to dispute the authority and power of the church. The original message preached by George Fox, who became the founder of the society, was that the knowledge of God comes from personal experience and not necessarily through the priesthood, words, or ceremonies. Quakers also believed that everyone is equal, whatever their social class, wealth, race, or gender. Quakers lived simple lives and adopted plain clothing, avoiding patterns, stripes, or decorative ribbons and frills. Plain, practical colours such as brown, cream, fawn, sage green, and grey were all recommended for Quaker women's clothing. We don't know who wore these bonnets, but they represent a period in Coalbrookdale's history in the late 18th century when the leading shareholders in the company were women, a time that became known as the petticoat management. You now approach the final section of this gallery, where the space narrows to accommodate a staircase located to the right. The displays continue straight ahead from this point and will eventually curve round to give access down the staircase to the first floor. In front of the staircase barrier, on a low plinth, are examples of early iron rails from an iron railway that was built to transport raw materials to the furnaces and later to move finished goods to the River Severn for onward transport downstream by boat. Along the full length of the far wall is an illustrated timeline giving information about further iron making in Ironbridge from 1707 to 1797, covering topics of iron puddling, steam power, railways, and the building of the Iron Bridge. In front of the timeline are two glass cases containing objects relating to the Coalbrookdale Company and the Iron Bridge. Against the middle of the left-hand wall, next to the windows, is a low rope barrier surrounding a small wheeled truck that ran on iron, pulled initially by horses. During this time, the Coalbrookdale Company worked with some of the leading engineers of the day, such as the Cornish engineer Richard Trelithick, who designed the world's first steam railway locomotive at Coalbrookdale in 1802. The exhibition display continues straight ahead from this point and will eventually curve round to the right, but we have another object to review before this. Directions to the whaling pot. Move straight ahead until you reach a large low plinth with a huge cast iron pot standing on it. This is a whaling pot, which was used to render down whale blubber. It has a brief audio-visual commentary to accompany it. This is operated by a movement sensor, so we'll begin as you approach the pot. Object 10, whaling pot. Compared to the earlier cooking pot, this is far larger. It stands approximately 1 metre high and 1.5 metres across. The shape is very much like the traditional idea of a witch's cauldron, except that it has two opposing flat sides rather than being fully spherical. This allowed several pots to be butted up against each other, either on deck or on shore. The pot is perched on three small pointed feet and has a small flared neck at the top with two small triangular handles. There are three raised ridges which run horizontally around the body of the pot. The pot is black in colour, reinforcing the impression of weight and strength. Although metallic, the surface is not smooth and glossy. It has a texture a little like orange peel, which is due to the casting process. Casting such a large and complex shape was a great challenge, and the Coalbrookdale Company was one of the leaders in this new technology. Directions to the model of the Iron Bridge. From the whaling pot, move to the right. Please mind the pillars here. The model is on your left, and if you continue to your right, you will approach the top of the staircase going down to the first floor. The large display in front of you contains a wooden scale model of the Iron Bridge made from mahogany by Thomas Gregory, who was foreman pattern maker for the Coalbrookdale Company. Gregory provided the joints for each of the iron ribs used to construct the Iron Bridge itself and oversaw the building of the bridge from 1779. Object 11, model of the Iron Bridge. The wooden model is made up of five parallel arches with interlocking joints, creating a semicircular arch as you face the bridge side on, and is a rich, deep, dark brown colour with gold lettering across one arch that says, This bridge was cast at Corbetdale and erected in the year 1779. The model shows how the road across the bridge slopes gently upwards towards the centre from both sides, flanked by decorative railings on each side. At the centre point on each side, the railings are embellished with decorative ironwork. Even though the model is a large structure, it is quite delicate in appearance. The bridge itself was the world's first cast iron bridge. It was erected in 1779 and opened to traffic on New Year's Day 1781. In the 18th century, the River Severn was the main route used to transport raw materials for industry, goods to market and people, but it was prone to drought in the summer and to flooding in the winter, making it an unreliable transport link. As local industries developed, it became obvious that a more permanent and reliable way for crossing was needed. Thomas Farnells Pritchard, an architect from Shrewsbury, came up with a design for a new bridge to be made of cast iron. A group of local businessmen, including John Wilkinson, approached Abraham Darby III with the plans, and he was commissioned to make it at his foundry. Abraham Darby III's decision to build the bridge was not only a practical solution to a problem, but an innovative way of showing the versatility of cast iron. The Iron Bridge remains the Corbetdale Company's most recognised and inspirational product, a catalyst for the architectural use of iron and steel. In the centre of the town's main street in Ironbridge, you can walk across the bridge and touch each side. This model of the bridge won a gold medal from the Royal Society of Arts in 1787, who wrote that the Society, sensible of the magnitude and importance of the Iron Bridge, have voted you their gold medal, which will be delivered to you in May next. Finally, to the right of the model is an Oliver or Tommy hammer, operated by a foot treadle, which was used to work iron with sharp, powerful blows. Such a hammer was in use at the Corbetdale Company Horsehay Works for over 100 years. First floor directions and context description. We now continue the tour on the first floor. If you prefer to take the lift, please make your way back through the gallery to the lift at the far end. If you wish to take the stairs, facing the Ironbridge model, you now bear right to approach the staircase, which is located on the left-hand side of the gallery with the windows to your left. There is a red carpet at the top of the staircase, differentiating the hard floor in the main gallery from the staircase approach and stairs. You turn right down the staircase with handrails on both sides. You walk down to a landing, turn another right and continue down. Then you come to another landing and turn left into the gallery on the first floor through double doors. This first floor gallery space is the same shape and size as the upper floor, but is laid out differently. You will go around this floor in an anti-clockwise direction, returning eventually to the stairwell you have just descended. To reach the emergency exit from this floor, return to the staircase you have just come down and proceed down to the ground floor, or go in an anti-clockwise direction to the far end of the gallery and turn right in front of the windows facing you, through a door into the loft lobby, where there is an evacuation chair which will be operated by a member of museum staff in the case of an emergency when the lift must not be used. Back in the gallery, directly in front of you, is a huge ship's anchor at least 14 foot or 4.26 metres in length. Object 12, anchor. This is an enormous wrought iron anchor weighing over a ton, which has a central shank with slightly curved barbed flukes protruding on either side. The shank is roughly 14 foot long and has a large iron ring looped through the top. The flukes extend either side from the base of the shank for a length of approximately 4 feet each at a 45 degree angle. The grain of this wrought iron is very prominent and its fibrous looking texture is visible to the eye. It resembles tree bark, almost as though a smooth piece of iron has been lightly scored from top to bottom of the central shank and along the length of the flukes. It has been worn by the sea and salt over time, and the surface is textured. This anchor was recovered from the seabed of the English Channel, about 15 to 20 miles west of Portland Bill, off the coast of Dorset. It follows the design of a Royal Dockyard anchor and is believed to date from the period of the Napoleonic Wars from 1799 to 1815. It probably belonged to a third-rate fighting ship or a fifth-rate frigate, a lighter and faster naval vessel. Whilst an anchor like this would not have been forged here at Coalbrookdale, it is a superb example of the heavy forging of wrought iron. On the wall to the left of the door you have just entered by is a painting of the Iron Bridge by William Williams, painted in 1780 before the bridge was completed. Many other views of the Iron Bridge were produced by artists from the 18th century onwards because of its iconic status and as Ironbridge became a destination for travellers and tourists. In this first section ahead of you is a long narrow case displaying more views of the Iron Bridge on either side of its length. Around the outer wall, on the other side of the glass display cabinet, the timeline continues, and display cases here hold examples of transport-related decorative items from the Elton collection. As you continue your tour in an anti-clockwise direction, move towards a wooden chair set on a plinth. Object 13, William Ball's chair. This simply designed wooden chair was custom made for William Ball of Horsay, Shropshire, almost 200 years ago. On the wall behind is an illustration of William, who was known locally as the Shropshire Giant on account of his immense strength and his remarkable size. And the proportions of this chair reveal how physically impressive a man he was. The seat of the chair is made from a generous semicircle of smooth solid elm, which measures approximately 80 centimetres or 30 inches across its diameter and is 8 centimetres or 3 inches thick. The seat is supported on four sturdy plain legs, which splay out slightly to better take the weight of its occupant. Rising from the rear of the seat are seven evenly spaced simple spindles, which are topped by a thick curved wooden rail, forming a rest for William's back and arms. The piece is designed and shaped to comfortably accommodate William's substantial frame. The wood of the chair is a lovely warm brown elm, showing paler patches on the seat where it has worn, and darker areas of staining around the joints and on the lower portions of the legs where they came to meet the floor. William Ball worked for the Coalbrookdale Company from the age of 8 and for the following 40 years, first as a puddler or stirrer of molten iron, and then as a shingler, hammering out the iron to remove impurities. William's career in the foundry was brought to a premature end when his sight was severely damaged by a small piece of molten iron which entered his left eye. Unable to continue working for the Coalbrookdale Company, William turned his great size to his advantage. Weighing in at around 40 stone and with a 6-foot girth, he found fame touring county fairs where he exhibited himself under the name of John Bull, the largest man in Britain. William died in 1852 at the age of 57. Local legend has it that he was carried to his grave by means of straps and poles by some 20 of his former workfellows. Close by, behind you, there is also a large interactive table displaying images from the archives which you can explore and enlarge by touching the images. Directions to the audio stories. Beyond the table and against the wall between two windows, you may listen to the stories and voices of three people, John Jarvis, Moses Evans and Annie Payne, who lived and worked in the local area in the early to mid 20th century. The audio stories are via an old-fashioned phone that you pick up, and on the right are three buttons which, when pushed, trigger the stories. From top to bottom, they are for John Jarvis, Moses Evans, Annie Payne. The people speaking have Shropshire accents, and it is well worth listening to their stories. As you continue around the gallery space, there are cast iron and wooden benches which you are welcome to touch and sit on. Beyond the benches, there are a series of displays, some in cases, and including a display of cast iron doorstops in the centre of the room, along with freestanding items of cast iron furniture and sculpture towards the outer wall. Between the iron benches and the wall of the audio stories, if you walk down to the far right corner of the gallery, here is a statue of Andromeda and a large ornamental urn. Object 14, Andromeda, designed by John Bell. This is a life-size black cast-iron statue depicting a nude female figure standing on rocks. Andromeda's head is looking down towards the ground in a pose of subjugation. Her long wavy hair is twisted into two tresses which run down the back of her head between her shoulder blades and ending halfway down her back. Her right knee is bent due to her foot resting on a small rock. In front of her left foot is a small slug-like sea creature. Her hands are behind her back, and an ornate chain runs from her wrists straight down to the rocky outcrop, where it is secured by two rings which are attached to a figure of a three-headed creature. The statue is mounted on top of a circular black cast-iron pedestal, which is about 2.5 feet high. In Greek mythology, Andromeda was the daughter of the Ethiopian king Cepheus and his wife Cassiopeia. When Cassiopeia angered the gods to appease Poseidon, Andromeda was chained to the rocks to be sacrificed to a sea monster, Cetus, but she was rescued by Perseus, who slayed the monster with either his sword or turned it to stone by producing the severed head of the Gorgon Medusa from a sack. This statue was designed by John Bell, 1811 to 1895, and was manufactured by the Coalbrookdale Company. Another version of it was made and exhibited at the Great Exhibition held at Crystal Palace in 1851 and later bought by Queen Victoria. That is now in the gardens of Osborne House on the Isle of Wight, the Queen's summer residence. Directions to the Deerhound Table. Continuing counterclockwise and keeping the windows to your right, freestanding displays of agricultural, garden, street and domestic products made by the Coalbrookdale Company are complemented by cabinets located under the windows which contain many smaller items. Between you and the staircase, you will come to a huge table supported by life-sized cast-iron deerhounds. Be careful as there is another pillar in front of you as you cross over to the table. Object 15, Deerhound Table. This object is described as a hall table and was obviously intended as an impressive introduction to a large and prestigious house. It is worn in places, so has been well used. The table, about the size and shape of a large dining table, is made entirely of cast iron, but is richly decorated with bronze, gilt and painted effects. The tabletop has bowed edges, and suspended beneath each side are moulded decorative panels of leaves, branches and acorns. In the centre of each of these panels is a heraldic shield. The table's four legs are large cast iron deerhounds sitting very upright and alert. The casting of the dogs is very lifelike, even down to the way their fur is depicted. And although there is a do not touch sign, their shiny noses suggest that in the past, visitors were unable to resist stroking them. The tabletop rests on their shoulders, and their heads, with noses pointing slightly up, protrude to the corners of the table to about 30 centimetres above the table surface. Each dog has a breastplate with a painted coat of arms. The dogs are seated on scrolled ironwork, which connects under the table with a central supporting pedestal. This table, the largest known piece of cast iron furniture, was the Coalbrookdale Company's showpiece at the 1855 Paris International Exhibition. Like the statue of Andromeda, it was designed by John Bell, who was responsible for several of the company's prestige pieces. It is the only known version, however, and the coat of arms around the neck of each dog is that of John Hargreaves of Lancashire. His eldest son married in 1855, so perhaps this splendid piece was specially commissioned to celebrate that event. To the left of the Deerhound Table is a very large horizontal display illustrating a map of the world showing how thousands of items manufactured by the Coalbrookdale Company were exported globally, particularly to the former colonies of the British Empire and beyond. In many instances, these included architectural elements used to construct colonial buildings such as churches, hospitals and factories. Directions to the ground floor. From the map, go to the right towards the doors to the staircase. The stairs, covered in red carpeting, descend on your left. Go down two flights of stairs and turn left through a set of double doors. Turn left down another short flight of five steps. There is a handrail on both the left and right-hand sides. You come to a brick floor, so you will notice the change in the floor surface. At this point, you turn right and then follow the wall and then turn left and go straight ahead through a single doorway. Bottom floor description. This is a small gallery with an original cobbled floor back on the ground floor of the museum. Around the walls are images of iconic structures such as the Eiffel Tower, Golden Gate Bridge, Tower Bridge, the Titanic and Sydney Harbour Bridge, which could not have been made without the developments in iron technologies at Coalbrookdale. Set into the ground are railway tracks on which wagons would have stood while being loaded up with goods coming to and from this warehouse. At the far end of the tracks are two large double wooden doors which would have been opened when the wagons were moved. Directions to the Aga Cooker. The exit doors are located on the left-hand wall. To the right of these, there are two Aga Cookers, and to the left of the doors, information panels which detail the decline of industry in the Ironbridge Gorge in the 20th century and the rise of the Ironbridge Gorge Museum Trust in 1967 to preserve its industrial heritage. Object 16, Aga Cooker. Standing in front of you is an Aga Cooker. Invented in Sweden in 1922 by Nobel Prize winning Swedish physicist Gustav Dahlén, it was later produced in Coalbrookdale from 1957 onwards. This unused large cast iron box is enamelled in a dark aubergine purple colour with a black top, giving the cooker a smooth protective finish. Two raised shiny metal covers protect the user from the ceramic hot plates. The very heavy lids are lifted with a coiled metal handle. A rail stands out along the length of the cooker for the drying and storing of clothing or kitchen items. The front of the Aga is a rectangle divided into quarters. There is a windowless door in three of the quarters except the top left section. In the centre of this section features a small raised oval Aga logo with silver scroll lettering and edging. A small temperature gauge features above the doors on the right. Though now cold to the touch, if in working order, it would be hot as it adopts the principle of heat storage. The heavy frame of cast iron absorbs the heat from a continuously burning source. The accumulated heat can then be used when needed for cooking. Originally coal-fueled, in the 1960s, Agas fired by oil and gas were introduced. In 1912, Gustav Dahlén was blinded in an acetylene explosion, the same year he won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry. He invented the all-in-one cooker, water heater and laundry dryer to help ease the domestic burdens of his wife, Elma. In the 1930s, the popularity of the cream enamelled Aga with well-to-do country society was quickly established. An Aga featured in the kitchen of Doris and Dan Archer in the long-running BBC radio story, The Archers. Until 2017, Agas were still made at Coalbrookdale by the Aga Rangemaster Group, close to the spot where iron cooking pots were first cast by Abraham Darby I 300 years ago. You may touch this item, but please don't try to lift the lids as they are very heavy. Directions to the exit. To leave this final part of the gallery, go through the double doors to the left of the Aga Cookers, and you will enter the shop and arrive back to where you started the tour and the first object, the Eagle Slayer. And this brings us to the end of the tour. We hope you have enjoyed exploring the museum with this audio descriptive tour, and we look forward to welcoming you again.